I think we have segued to the issue of the part played by examining boards and bodies in determining what is and isn't taught and what is and isn't read. I think, Martin Roberts, you've got a question, which is Martin Roberts here? One moment, the microphone is heading in your direction.
I'm presently coordinating the history programme of the Prince's Teaching Institute, but I think the most relevant thing is I did actually teach history before the national curriculum. I was a head of department in the 1970s. And some of us here, who are not in the first flush of youth, are saying déjà vu. And the last time I was in the same room as Kenneth Baker was when I was part of a HA delegation to try and persuade him that the ideas we had for a history curriculum were really good, and probably slightly better than him and his advisors. And we had an interesting conversation, but I don't think the outcome was exactly what we hoped. The question is this, and I think there's a really significant context, which is when I was young, there was no control about what teachers did, and we thought we would get it right. Then in 1988 to 1990, things were turned on their heads, and we lost curriculum control, and it passed mainly to politicians. And we've moved now into a very interesting situation. I'm not quite sure if people have got Michael Gove right, and I'm not sure whether Michael Gove knows quite what he's after. But on this morning he said, this morning he said he believed in a broad, balanced curriculum, even though he believed in freedom, which would take us back, I think, to Chris Husband's argument, the reason why history matters for everybody, that it's an essential part of a civilized curriculum, which leads me to my question, which is, how and by whom should the subject matter of history courses in schools and in other subjects be decided, and how often should those decisions be reviewed?
Well, perhaps we could embellish the question a little and say, who is doing the deciding now and who ought to do the deciding? Anybody on the panel want to have a go at that? Steve?
I think I started off by saying that I think one of the reasons why history teaching is so good in this country is because the national curriculum is broad and flexible and balanced. And if you read it very carefully, I have a copy of it here. I won't read the whole of the national curriculum for history to you. It says very, very clearly, pupils should have a secure chronological framework, the major events in British, European, and world history, covering at least the medieval, early modern, industrial, and 20th century periods. They should understand the development of democracy and the changing relationship between the crown and parliament, etc., etc. If I ask how many people in secondary school teach the Battle of Hastings, show of hands, it's not in the national curriculum, you don't have to teach it. What if I said Cromwell? How many teach Cromwell and the Civil War, Charles I? It's not in the national curriculum. Let's go with one more. What about Beckett? Beckett, Henry II, struggle between crown and church. George the Third. So actually, this chronological framework that the national curriculum advises us to teach, I would say the vast majority of history teachers are delivering this. Now, if you're lucky enough to be in a school where history is valued by your senior leadership and you're given adequate time to teach this broad sweep of history, we're not talking teaching it in a grad grinding way, just facts, just facts, just facts, and you get through it all. We're talking about genuinely teaching, allowing pupils to climb into this period, the wonderful stories and narratives and the colorful characters that are just like we are today, and instilling a lifelong love of history in our pupils. If you're given the time to do that, you can include things like George III, and more on the 19th century prime ministers, and all of these things that the Daily Mail beats us up with because we don't teach it. And if we did teach it, they'd beat us up because we don't teach other things. I'm not actually sure that the Daily Mail's concerned with accuracy when reporting history anyway, but except when it comes to beating up history teachers. So when it comes to Martin's question about who should decide this, I agree that for too long, the exam boards at GCSE are telling us what we teach. And if you're in a school that has 18% A star to C, and you get, as a head of department in your pigeonhole, which I'm inundated with, an exam board advertising that real results guaranteed to improve, these are the statistics, we'll teach it modular, we'll examine them every other month, will take the best grade that they get, not the last grade, the best one. So if they get one C out of 12 Fs, we'll take the C. If you're inundated with league tables and pressure from SLT, of course you're going to go with the easier exam board. It stands to reason. This is another circle that Michael Gove has to square. If you give schools freedom, then freedom to choose the exam board, do you go with the easiest one? Okay, well, let's scrap the exam boards. Let's have no free market in exam boards. Let's have one national exam board so you can compare GCSE results in Newcastle with results in Cambridge and Cornwall. Is that the way to do it?
Well, that's
I would
question.
Support that personally.
What is the general view, or what are different views of the audience about this issue of exam boards? Anybody want to offer comments on that? And then this person here, and then the man in the white shirt.
I think the point is something that I think Chris said, which is that they're businesses. And they're run entirely as businesses, whereas they originated in the universities. And those links between higher education and examining have been almost entirely cut. Mm. The Cambridge Board officially is a department of the university, but in reality it's run completely separately. So I think they have to open their doors to other interested bodies, of which I think higher education is a very important one, and stop behaving as in exactly the way Steve's just described, essentially as businesses out touting for business.
Chris, do you want to say something, and then the person in the white shirt, and then we'll come back to Ken.
Yes, well, Chris. As a senior manager in a university, we're looking for new business opportunities. So Martin's question was how and by whom should the subject matter be decided? And I think that we haven't quite addressed that square on. When I began teaching, there was a curricular free-for-all. Not quite, but substantially. And it didn't work. You got some outstanding practice, you got some very uneven practice. Neither, I think, has it worked, or would it work, for a wholly centralised curriculum structure. I think it was one of Lord Baker's even more distinguished predecessors, Sir Keith Joseph, who said that history in, I think he said, St. Helens and Dorset should not necessarily be the same, that it should reflect local circumstance. Seems to me the job of politicians is a legitimate job in a democratic society for elected politicians to set a framework for the curriculum. It's not a job of elected politicians to define in detail the precise content of the curriculum, but to define aims and a framework. Teachers have a responsibility to develop the curriculum within the aims and framework that are established by government. So my answer is a framework and teachers and regular review. And I am incredibly disturbed, not by the details so much of this as the principle, by the abolition of an arm's length body that had the formal responsibility for curriculum review, because I'm worried, not necessarily about this Secretary of State, because I don't know him, but I'm worried about any Secretary of State taking to himself or herself the power to define in detail the content of the curriculum without the requirement to take external advice. I think, and I'm sure the history teachers in the room will agree with me, that there are societies in the past that we teach our children about that have seen that happen and have rued the consequences.
The gentleman there, and then Ken Baker.
Hello, Nick Vanderpeek from the Imperial War Museum. Sitting here, coming from an education system in New Zealand, a lot of what you're saying, we've tried, and a lot of it works. So the lady over there talking about the alternatives to the one system, we've done that, I've done that, it works. What you're saying here about a generic idea, it works. We have one curriculum, works. So a lot of these ideas that are coming up, they do work. Maybe look beyond. I'd certainly agree that a lot of the things are being said are good. We have a generic social studies, but like our island thing here, it all works. So I think you should go with some of this innovation. Yeah.
Okay, well, intellectual life in New Zealand is obviously thriving. Ken.
Well, goodbye New Zealand. But first, politicians do not determine the curriculum.
I agree entirely with what was said. All a politician can do is to determine the framework for a curriculum, which is what I did. And I set up various groups for each subject and took great pains to try and get the balance right. I appointed many people at the recommendation of the Institute of Education, to the various panels. I knew history was going to be a battlefield. I knew that. I didn't expect maths to be a battlefield, but I discovered feudal armies marched across the maths field. Should you learn tables by heart? What about calculating machines? Should you do trigonometry before 16? The passion raised was as great as anything that you have in history. In English, I tried to get the balance right. I first appointed a group of extreme right-wingers to produce a rigorous curriculum for... It didn't work. They came out, they didn't want grammar, they didn't think much of spelling. So I had to set up another group. But I wasn't telling them what to do. And Michael Gove will find that problem. He can create a mood. He will say he likes history, but that's about all he can say in actual fact. He hasn't got the instruments to change it. And the examining boards then are another great stumbling block if you want to change the actual nature of the content. The content of the history curriculum comes essentially from educationalists and from your body of historians, essentially. There's not any politicians trying to maneuver it. Politicians on the whole who try to manipulate curriculums don't succeed. Margaret Thatcher didn't have her way, for example. She wanted an entirely different sort of curriculum. The only politician I ever met in the world who said, I'm going to write the curriculum, was my French counterpart, Monsieur Chevènement, who was an extreme socialist. He said, I'm going to write the history curriculum of France over the weekend myself.
I think Stalin had a try in Russia. And as has been said, that's a route we'd rather, I think, not go. But the point that's been raised about the examining bodies is, I think, an interesting one. And, of course, in some ways it does connect with this notion that we may like to think or we may fear that ministers have a lot of power. But, of course, there's a constant conspiracy between the media and government to persuade us that government is very powerful, and actually it often isn't. And it's not worry about government power that we should exercise. It's often worry about the fact that they aren't powerful enough.